Hey folks, welcome to a new episode of Long Shots. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, and we're on a run of interesting podcasts. I'm excited today as well, I always am, right?
This is episode number 96, my friend.
Wow. Yeah.
And so it's been a long haul.
Yeah.
We had a long stretch where it was just both of us.
Yeah.
Thank God that ended.
Yeah.
And it's been a roll of, you know, founders, entrepreneurs. A lot of people from the market side recently.
Yeah.
We had Harsh Tolani, we had Vivek, where we spoke about value investing, followed by factor investing. So a lot of actionable market intel being thrown one way or the other. A long line of fintech guys as well. And speaking of fintech, we have with us Mr. Jitin Basin. Hi, Jitin. How are you?
I'm good, Nikhil. Hi. Hi, Sharad.
Hi. No, thanks for taking the time out, and good to have you.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And Jitin is the founder and CEO of Savin, a neo banking platform. But before we kind of talk more about Savin, Jitin has got a long history of operating closely in fintech. He was, he spent a fair number of years at Bank Bazaar. He was most recently an MD at Rupee Ready. And, so he's been around the block.
Mm-hmm.
He understands the interface between finance, between technology, how to look at, you know, lending, payments in a more 2020 type of scenario. So it's an absolute pleasure to have him with us. So Jitin, I obviously, you know, like to start from the start with you, in the sense that Savin right now is operating, I would say, in stealth mode, in hibernation mode. You guys are must be quite busy with your product development plans, and would obviously like to hear a bit more about Savin. But before that, you know, just for the benefit of our listeners, we just threw very smartly the word neobanks in the beginning of the podcast. But I'm sure a lot of the guys are like, what the hell are these people talking about? So, you know, from the horse's mouth, what exactly are neobanks? Why are they, you know, recently gaining so much traction around? You know, there's a lot of narrative around the neobanking setup. You know, recently we heard a large banking institution get wrapped on the knuckles by RBI because there were digital outages. So that, I think, all enhanced the neobanking narrative even more. So, you know, probably a bit of an explainer to start with in terms of what these platforms are, what they are supposed to do, what gap are they filling, and then we'll go a bit more into Savin. How does that sound?
Sure. Thanks, Nikhil. So I think, yes, I mean, I think it's very important to understand that some of these terminologies, right? So the way I look at it, fintech has been evolving in this country over the last 8 to 10 years specifically, right? And payments has always been ahead of the curve. If you see the growth and the maturity curve of payments in this country, perhaps it's second to none, right? And when we talk about neobanks, I think, you know, leaving aside the nomenclature, right, I believe that there are various ways and means in which you can define a neobank. So to me, I think let's understand what a bank is, right? A bank is an interface, let's say, from a retail customer perspective, and I'm not going on the corporate side. Of course, there is a corporate side as well. But from a retail consumer perspective, a bank is a place where you can park your deposits, which becomes liabilities for institutions, and they obviously help you out with some funding, which become their assets. And, you know, lending costs them money and assets make the money, and hence they make money on the differential. It's actually a very simple business if you were to look at it simply. And amongst the retail banking products, you have lending, you have credit cards, you have debit cards, you have payments, you have, let's say, some deposit products like fixed deposits, recurring deposits, right? This is banking, right? But when people talk about new banking being new, I actually do not agree, because new banking may just be a different term.
Mm-hmm.
If you see, there are more than 400 fintech lending institutions in the country. So what they're doing is they're solving one problem, let's say, which is lending, and they're solving it digitally. So some of them may be doing it on their own license, just like I was perhaps in my previous, you know, experience. I was running a NBFC and a fintech company,
mm-hmm.
two separate entities. So we could, let's say, just, you know, allow our NBFC to build an asset, but we could have worked with another lending company, and that should have been called a neo banking, you know, in brackets, lending institution,
right?
Because we were covering one part of banking, which, let's say, is lending, right? Some other institutions have focused only on payments, which also traditionally was an instrument which resided only with banks. But
yeah.
Over time, it went to wallets. Over time, it went to, let's say, something like a UPI has completely democratized the way people, you know, transfer money today from point A to point B. That should also be technically called neobanking, because there is, let's say, an element, huge element of banking, which is payments and movement of money, funds transfer is a big instrument, right?
Mm.
So I think over the period of evolution. Today, entities which are perhaps being called neobanks or let's say digital banks or challenger banks, the way you want to call them, right? As I see, they are trying to address various problems, which they see may be opportunities, right? And they may want to co-create those opportunities with, let's say, some regulated entities. And they want to cover liabilities. They want to cover assets. Some of them want to focus only on, let's say, lending side. Some of them want to focus on asset side, you know, liabilities side, right? And some of them want to focus on investment side.
Right.
So as I see, neobanking may be a new term, but I think in India, it's been prevalent for quite a while. In general, India does not have a licensing regime, as you may know, for new banks to operate in isolation. But these new banking entities work with a mainstream regulated entity or more than one. And they provide mainstream banking services and financial services in partnership with such institutions. So I think it's fairly disruptive. And it will allow a huge amount of, let's say, penetration at a customer level. And that's what new banks are currently aspiring to do.
I mean, but while obviously, you know, the there is a broader undertone behind the terminology of neobanks, but like a more, I would say, accessible impression of that term is that this is some sort of a digital first type of a proposition, right? And naturally, that is probably one of the reasons why it has been gaining so much traction in recent years, you know, with the entire evolution of mobile first, mobile banking, and also with the fact that often traditional banking institutions have legacy systems when it comes to catering or solving digital problems. But like you briefly mentioned in between that there's no quote-unquote licensing regime for neobanks. That, now, that's a very big if. That's a very big kind of, I'm sure, I mean, who am I to say you guys are running this business? You guys must be kind of, you know, all up on that entire debate. So, you know, just to understand, when you say licensing regime, you're actually talking about the actual right to underwrite or to lend.
No. So I think that's where I think the understanding of the segment needs to evolve amongst various participants, right?
Yeah.
See, for example, let's say India is flushed with fintech entities which have been facilitating lending. Now, it does not mean that all of them have NBFC or banking licenses, right? And you have some of the biggest names facilitating lending today, but you work with somebody else and you allow the underwriting to happen by a regulated entity. So the very essence of, let's say, fintech participation along with, let's say, mainstream regulated entities is that regulated entities have experience of setting up large infrastructure. Perhaps some of them have huge retail presence. Some of them have great ability at risk underwriting, right? So from that perspective, the endeavor of a fintech entity is that can you leverage the existing skill set, infrastructure, investment of a large institution? It could be a bank or an NBFC. And can you lay on top of it, let's say, a collaborative layer, which can allow you to reach a much larger set of population while not compromising on the basics of, let's say, either compliance or risk underwriting. In terms of risk, of course, you can enable risk assessment. And I think there has been a spectacular, let's say, performance which has been delivered by fintech entities when it comes to lending. It's demonstrated, it is established, and today fintechs have a lion's share of overall, let's say, unsecured lending in this country already. It is a fact. Right. So as far as I'm concerned, I think there is a huge amount of information. There's a huge amount of data and analytics which fintechs have brought to the table.
Yeah.
And they have created this along with, let's say, some regulated entities. And today banks are extremely open in this regard. So I see that it's a fairly, let's say, symbiotic relationship because fintechs have their own strengths. Banks have their own strengths. And when it comes to neobanking, right, quote unquote, it is about, let's say, creating and leveraging those areas of strengths, essentially.
But I mean, like, I mean, you know, if you kind of try to become a devil's advocate here, I mean, isn't, I mean, one kind of often thinks that, I mean, every fintech worth its name in the long run wants to actually enter the business of underwriting itself. And I mean, at the end of the day, that entire part of the value chain is strictly controlled as of now, rightly so, to a certain extent. But also there are barriers to entry, which have, I mean, there was a time when peer-to-peer kind of when during its really early nascent years when nobody was looking at it that closely, it was like a, it was kind of probably following the same trajectory as the China model. But, you know, one fine day RBI came in and stepped in and said, look, if you're kind of trying to take, adopt the entire lending value chain, become an NBFC, you know, put in that much amount of capital, come under some sort of a basic risk profiling or basic, you know, regulatory control. And that obviously meant a lot of the so-called early guys who wanted to get into that space would now go into some other domain. I mean, there's that entire narrative that by regulating money flows too much, often fintechs end up as becoming, I would say, customer acquisition channels for bigger banks, rather than actually ones who are able to underwrite themselves. Do you think that debate is kind of an unfair characterization? Or do you think there are too many pockets of value to be unlocked in the technology spectrum itself, that just the fact that, you know, you are not lending from day one shouldn't be an issue from a business perspective?
See, I think, let's say, you know, the very fact when people say that fintech sometimes, you know, cannot lend, let's say, as you rightly said, right? Lending is not the only thing that you do in banking.
Yeah.
Please refer to what we started our discussion with. So when you open your banking relationship, the first thing that you do is you set up an account. Right.
Yeah.
Technically,
yeah.
You set up an account, you have payments which is flowing. There is, let's say, some streams of revenue for the institution facilitating that. That's one. Second, of course, is that yes, and there are, let's say, some deposits which eventually have to create some assets, and hence the bank makes money on, let's say, some kind of asset creation. But there are various shapes and sizes. There are various avenues wherein a, you know, an early stage fintech company can invest and can create value, which will be seen by partners and maybe more than one partner, right, in the long run. So I feel that the ability to lend stems from the license to lend.
Right.
And the ability to lend stems from the understanding of risk and balancing the risk versus return, right? And there is a wide range of people in this country, institutions in this country, who are lending across spectrums, right? So I fundamentally believe, I would like to lean towards the latter part of your conversation, that there is enough value that can be still unlocked. Nikhil, and I think it's been demonstrated across the globe, not only India. There are huge fintech entities which do not lend a single rupee,
mm-hmm.
but they have still created value, right? So the point I'm trying to make is I'm not belittling the value of lending, and I think, and I feel very passionately about it. But I also feel at the same time that there's a huge, let's say, potential to disrupt mm-hmm. a lot of other parts of the supply chain, which is being done very aggressively today by very passionate set of people in this country. And I believe that there is enough value in that as well. Also, since you spoke about licensing, you know, especially digital banking licenses, right? I mean, if you are following the space, you would have seen that earlier this week, 4 licenses have been allotted by Singapore regulatory authority, right? In Hong Kong, already 8 licenses have been allotted. In the US, in the Europe, already this is all a licensed regime. So I fundamentally believe that currently, I think the ecosystem is such that if you want to create a business model wherein you can piggyback and leverage the strengths of, let's say, licensed institution,
yeah.
in the most compliant manner possible, right? There is business to be made there. Over time, how the regulation will evolve, how the participants will need to, let's say, respond to that situation. I think personally, I feel that regulation in this country is quite enabling. And the regulator always has taken a forward-looking stance. As I said, right, our infrastructure on fintech is second to none.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, from my vantage point, I feel that this is an area which, you know, regulation is welcome. Right, as and when it comes. But I think that there is enough value that the entities can yet create by participating with regulated entities while, let's say, taking care of compliances which are mandatory.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that backdrop, sort of, how do you, you know, what is the business model with Savin? How do you expect it to, you know, grow over the near to medium term? What is the, you know, we talked about the several value additive layers that can be created. What is, you know, is there a target value additive layer that you're focusing on, or is it something that, you know, you expect and hope to figure out on the way as the product grows, as you gain traction, as customers start interfacing with you and you get more and more data points and sort of you come up with new problem statements, or do you have a vision in your mind right now?
No, I think, Sharat, I think, you know, any startup, right, always tries to solve problems in general. You mm-hmm. see an opportunity, you see a problem, you see a pain point, and you potentially want to address it. But sometimes you start with X and that X does not remain static during the course of evolution, right? So I think we at Savin are clear about both. We have a vision and we have clarity of thought in terms of the problem that we see and therefore the solution that we're building. So the solution that we're building is the following. Savin, as the name suggests, right, is a platform which is very passionate and dedicated to making people save incrementally on every rupee, you know, each amount of, let's say, unit rupee that they have, right, in their pocket. So we are building a retail consumer focused platform, which will allow a customer to open, let's say, a savings account,
mm-hmm.
right, with us. And when I say with us, we will work with a partner banking institution in that regard. So you can open an account completely digitally, as Nikhil mentioned, that neobanks mm-hmm. have to be paperless, presenceless, digital, right? By definition, so are we. So we expect you to be onboarded on a savings account proposition within, you know, let's say under 5 minutes, right? And you will get, let's say, a virtual debit card, or you will get, let's say, a credit card product, which we also want to create, let's say, very well-defined contours on approval rates of credit cards. So we are very passionate about the fact that while in India, there are about 800 million plus debit cards in circulation, but the number of credit cards in this country is still about 50 million, mm-hmm. right? So, and that also is with less than 30 million people. Mm-hmm. So the penetration of credit, therefore, in this country remains low. And I'm talking about credit, which is available as a line, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a credit card. So we at Savin want to create a savings account focused product and allow the customer to experience the best of the savings account, first of all, because we see that there are tremendous opportunities that one can still, let's say, leverage on the basic savings account chassis, right, along with the debit and credit facilities coming in the form of a credit card with, let's say, quasi-guarantee. Now, how do we do that quasi-guarantee is actually stemming from some of the other products that we are going to bring in the table. And of course, we'll offer basic banking products like payments, etc., which are normal because, you know, that's something which we believe that we are more passionate about currently disrupting some of the other lines, right? So basic banking products on offer. But when I talk about, let's say, predictability of credit, we are launching two very disruptive products, first mm-hmm. of them being a financial health score. So right. I personally feel that today, let's say, you know, when we are speaking, all of us have some sort of a credit footprint. And I think today, the bulk of India realizes the value of a credit score. But a credit score is an amalgamation of information, which sometimes is, you know, comes with a lag.
Yeah.
Potentially, it could be a lag of 4 to 5 months as well, right? Because it is based on historical factors and not necessarily real-time factors, mm-hmm. right? And let's say if you dial back 9 months, the period of COVID has brought this to, you know, attention quite significantly, because let's say if I lost a job, my credit score would not know that my income has gone down drastically, right? For example, I'm just giving one example, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say it's a very acute example, mm-hmm. but it is nevertheless an example. So we are creating a financial health score, which will do two things. A, it will put you in charge of your own financial health, and hence your credit score will potentially become a subset. Of course, we will take input from the credit score. So it's not that the two scores will be, let's say, diametrically opposite to each other. Ideally, they should talk to each other well, because credit score is a well, you know, let's say, established mechanism in sure. the country, and quite a large footprint India has. Plus, add on top of it some of the other alternate lines, including social, including, let's say, some behavioral traits, including some of the investment traits. Let's say if you've made an insurance, you have an insurance for yourself, potentially your financial health score should look, you know, northeasterly, let's say, on a let's say, map, right?
Hmm.
So some of these things we will overlay and create a real-time mechanism for people to be in charge of their overall financial health.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, never be checkmated by an adverse situation which may be presented if they go for, let's say, obtaining credit, which happens very liberally because the credit approval rates in the country continue to be quite low. So this is one product. And another product that we are launching is a very disruptive social finance product, which we want to invoke a lot of, let's say, social finance transactions amongst people. And we believe that it's a product, you know, which can significantly create a lot of disruption in the way people transact today mm-hmm. about their finance transactions. It's a product that we filed a patent for, and we've established novelty as well, right? Global novelty, actually. And we are working on these products. We want to, just to sum up, we want a customer to be onboarded into a retail banking environment and provide all the basic assets that you need to invoke your banking relationship, plus lay on top of it some very disruptive ideas. And I think our target group is, let's say, somebody who's potentially, let's say, under 35 in general. We could cater to people between 35 to 45 also, because the basic services are also in order.
Right.
But some of the disruptive products that we are bringing, I think, will have a big appeal to the millennial population, as I mm-hmm. see. And we are also cognizant of people who may not have entered banking, right? Which is, let's say, your Gen Z equivalent. So they may be at the cusp of entering banking. And we would like us to position, ourselves very, let's say, ably, so that we can educate them, we can make them save efficiently, right? We can provide them some insights, and we can provide them some disruptive ideas and products. And of course, a great UI UX, right? So a lot of people tell me that UI UX in isolation, let's say, may not be a disruptor, because a lot of new banks or fintech, right, they focus a lot on UI UX. I believe UI UX is important.
Yeah.
But disruptive products are actually, you know, very critical, and that's what we are focused on.
Yeah, but Jitin, millennials don't save, yeah? No, I'm just kidding. That's a joke. But, in terms of... You talked about even incorporating something like social footprint, you know, in terms of getting some kind of a credit score, or if not credit score, just trying to gauge some kind of credit worthiness, right? I mean, that's tech, right? That's all tech. That's got to be like sort of making sense of the right data points. So how do you go about capturing that data like off the bat, like considering someone who's new, you really don't have any hooks on the person or potential customer, right? I'm assuming he or she's coming as a fresher in terms of what you have on them. So how do you sort of go about, I can see that, you know, in 10 years you have so many data points that, you know, you can probably predict next purchase also, and that's probably where the value is. But how do you go about in the first innings, right? How do you sort of get that going?
So there are two aspects to it, right? Let's say, you know, if there could be somebody who has no data potentially with us. So let's say, you know, so how do we collect data?
Yeah.
So for somebody like us, we aim to collect data using, if you have a credit score, mm-hmm. we will perhaps have access to it with your consent. Mm-hmm. And we will build some sort of understanding basis that. But incrementally, as you work with us and you allow us to, let's say, you know, get access to some of the data that you're using, we will build it overnight. So it's not something which we can perhaps tell you on day one.
Yeah.
Because it does, we do not intend to give a lick and paste estimate of, let's say, what, you know, we feel is right. But we will profile you. We will be able to profile. We'll be able to get access to some data. That data may or may not be enough on day one. But what we will do, that we will create cohorts of this information and put you, let's say, in a specific profile group, which will indicate to us over a period of time, and then we will evaluate your transactional behavior, we will evaluate your social behavior, social fabric, we may evaluate, let's say, you know, your contact fabric, right, basics, mm-hmm. and then we may give you some indicators, which over time will get refined.
Yeah.
So therefore, our promise is not that, look, this is what you are and you should do it. It is more of, let's say, a guidance, and the classical debate of need-based, you know, financial products, consumption of financial products, right? I think we are trying to solve that problem also, because what happens is that a lot of people will come and advise you, why don't you do this? Why don't you create this product, right? But they don't necessarily know you enough. So from our perspective, we want to create a very non-intrusive interface, mm-hmm. which can know enough about you,
yeah.
and keep giving you guidance and keep incrementally improving. And for somebody who has, let's say, data, or somebody where we have data, it becomes a very scientifically strong mechanism to indicate where you are in life, how you are doing, right? If your debt to income is extremely high, if you don't have any insurance, if you have zero liquidity, right? Liquid funds, if you have all your money, let's say, in stocks, right? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
So some of these things will become very powerful indicators for us to profile you, to educate you, right? With the best of intention, and perhaps nudge you to make more efficient financial decisions if we can. And when we do that, we would like to provide you with a very seamless digital interface for you to consummate those journeys, right? So I think that's who we are. That's who we want to be. We want to understand the customer.
In a way, like there's an entire advisory piece also, right? I mean, that kind of is potentially the hook which kind of makes Savin a funnel for someone, you know, to kind of go through their personal finance journey. Is that the broad idea? Because, I mean, obviously, there's an initial customer acquisition event, you know, in terms of like one opens a basic suite of products, you know, be it a savings account, a debit card, a credit card, you know, you have a nice healthy dashboard, which kind of gives you, you know, a granular parameters in terms of where you stand. But then there's that entire advisory element which comes into it, which kind of makes you want to go to that application and, you know, kind of assess how the value add is actually playing out. Is that the broader kind of a direction?
Yeah, so I think you're right, Nikhil. So I think when Sharath mentioned that, you know, let's say, what is the problem that we are trying to solve? So when we wanted to start this business, right, the fundamental question that we asked ourselves is that why should we do this all? India has enough savings accounts. Everybody has a savings account, right? I mean, there are 80 crore debit cards out there. So I mean, there's no point of issuing another one if you already have one.
Right.
So why do this at all, right? So I think we asked ourselves this question really, really hard. And our read of the situation is the following, that of course India has, you know, India is not an underbanked country by any stretch of imagination, right? I think we are close to 95% plus banking penetration per household in this country already, right? Mm-hmm. I already discussed about the debit card penetration. It's quite significant, 800 million, 80 crore plus, right? So the reason we feel that somebody needs to perhaps be exposed to such a platform and why this platform should exist is about making sure that the smallest of financial decisions that you make mm-hmm. play on your side, play mm-hmm. to your strengths, right? And I think that happens when you make all things very transparent, very intuitive, very seamless and bring it to your notice, which sometimes goes unnoticed. I mean, if you see all the banking, you know, network in this country, every bank has an app, right?
Yeah.
You name it, right? Some banks may have more than one app also, right?
Sure. And some of them don't work as well.
They have a passbook app. Sorry?
No, I'm just saying some of them don't work also, but that's fine.
Some of them, maybe, right? Maybe.
Yeah.
But the thing is that from a customer perspective, the customer who's living in a Netflix generation, in a Swiggy generation, in an Amazon generation, right?
Mm.
If you see banking, right? If you had asked me in 1996, 98, 2000, I was happy with my Nokia phone, right? It was a phone. It worked. I was happy with that phone, right? But today, when I got exposed, and BlackBerry was, let's say, you know, the gold standard. But when we all got exposed to smartphones, we understood that a phone can do much more.
Yeah.
Similarly, today on your bank account, you would feel that, look, I can see my passbook, I can make my payments, my bank fetches me interest, I can book an FD. Why should I go to another platform?
Right.
But we do all the same things. The phone used to make a call, it does the same today. You could read SMSs, it does the same today. There was some connectivity, some social fabric. Maybe today there's a WhatsApp, etc. There's more computing power today that phones have. Exactly this, right? So this is the very essence of our existence. We are trying to not create a market which never existed.
Right.
Yeah.
The demand is there, right? The need is there. We are just trying to bring it in a very different avatar. Plus, lay on top of it other products. So as Nikhil mentioned, yes, there is a quasi-advisory. I wouldn't call it advisory, Nikhil, because advisory sometimes seems onerous, right? As I said, I use the word non-intrusive. We at Saven are very conscious of the fact that we need to nudge people enough, right? We don't need to push them hard. Because at the end of the day, we will have, minus the emotional situation of an individual, we may have access to all the objective information of the individual.
Hmm.
And I believe that there is an emotional situation and there is an objective situation. We will play with the objective situation so that emotional decisions on finance are not made. So I would like to call it that we would like to just be, let's say, some guide, right, wherein we can nudge people enough and let them make the decision that they feel is transparent and correct. So that's why we are trying to do this business. And, I personally feel that there is tremendous opportunity.
Yeah.
Right? In India, by the way, every year, 7 to 8 crore new banking accounts are open every year.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous number. If you dial back 4 or 5 years, you had to go to a bank branch, you had to fill up a form, some paperwork was to be done, and then the account will be opened. Then your checkbook will come, then your debit card will be dispatched, then you had to go to an ATM to set a debit card, right? All those, if I may call, fractured onboarding processes today don't exist.
Yeah.
So for the generation which is coming now, and even the generation that we are, right? If somebody tells you that, look, go to this platform, it'll manage your money more effectively, give you more insights, I think a lot of people are currently very, you know, inclined, because, you know, it's something which plays on your side.
Yeah.
Without any, let's say, onerous onboarding issues.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because, obviously we were talking for some time about, specifically about lending, and obviously from there we went into Saven. A lot of what you are saying, in a way, is already penetrated, at least in the area of payments, to a certain extent, right? In the sense that now you have big tech coming into payments, and big tech, they kind of came into payments, like, you know, companies like Google or Amazon, PhonePe, we all know the names. And then obviously the government in between came up with a UPI backend and kind of on one fine day made sure that you won't make money out of payments, right? But there is a common backend architecture that exists that you can kind of tap on. And now the same big tech firms are now getting into, okay, let me use my payments account as some way of cross-selling mutual funds or insurance products, right? So this space is kind of also, it's under the spotlight, you know, from the perspective of big fish also coming in, number one. And secondly, data is again a very, very, when we were kind of talking about, you know, how one can nudge a customer towards a certain direction, data, consent, privacy, those issues becomes so central, right? And the more and more banked our country gets, the more and more those issues will come in the limelight. And obviously, that's a very tricky kind of slope to navigate as well, right? In one way or the other. If you talk to a big tech co-founder or big tech CEO, their first answer is usually like, look, I need data. Without that, I can't make my experience the what it is. And okay, you can ask me to, you know, take the consent of users for 100 different things. But let's face it, at the end of the day, the users also beyond 2 or 3 things don't care. You know, nobody reads the terms and conditions. We just go ahead. Where do you see this debate, you know, going forward. I mean, obviously the regulator has not caught up with this. Regulator is still struggling to, you know, kind of see the confines of technology and how it's disrupting day-to-day living, be it in financial living, be it non-financial living. But how do you see the narrative, you know, kind of play out in the future? Do you see more stakeholder participation, more input from the industry? Do you see things like regulatory sandboxes coming in again and again, and, you know, in the fintech domain where the regulator says, look, I have no rules, let's give 6 months, figure out what you do. Once you reach a certain scale, then we'll create the rules. Like, what kind of, you know, I mean, I kind of ask these questions again and again, because I, for 5 years, I was in a very, I was in the UK where fintech was probably, you know, one of the most sophisticated in terms of, you know, how the regulator looked at them. And it was a very principle-based environment. You know, in UK, there was no rules. It's all principles-oriented. In India, it's the exact opposite. So it's all rules-based. Like, the RBI would actually tell exactly, if you are X type of institution, this is how much capital you need to hold. This is what you can sell. This is what you cannot sell. This is how much you have to price. But in fintech, it's impossible to do, right? I mean, because the technology is just jumping ahead and ahead. So in your conversations, you know, with the regulatory authorities, or in your conversations generally with the rest of the stakeholders, how do you see that regulatory environment cater to these problems? This is a very heavy, it's more of a rant rather than a question, as you must have realized. But I mean, I just want to understand your take on it, yeah?
No, I'll tell you, right? I'll tell you this, right? Say, you know, look at it from the perspective of the country, Nikhil. And I think the regulator always, let's say, in general, as I said, in my experience, and I have run regulated entities in the past, In my experience, I believe that the regulator has a very enabling view of the overall ecosystem. And the way Indian fintech market has matured, it is testimony to that. And we haven't had any event which, let's say, was extremely draconian, if I may call, right? And you gave the example of P2P, and I think the regulator did step in at the right time and, you know, created some ecosystem for them, because they must have seen some you know, events in some other geographies, etc. I fundamentally believe that today, amongst the stakeholders, starting from the customer who is at the receiving end of information or products and services, to regulated entities, to the regulator, to fintech participants, have realized there is a tremendous opportunity in collaboration, right? You look at it from, let's say, some of the more penetrated areas like payments. Dial back 7-8 years, could we have ever imagined that all our payments will reside out of banks, mostly, yeah, right? It was unthinkable, perhaps, at that point, right? But the very fact that the customer has become educated, the customer has become smart, the customer has become sensitive to the fact that, yes, I can perform my payments outside in a secure, in a, you know, in a transparent, in a, let's say, consistent manner, is testimony to the fact that the Indian customer has also evolved significantly, right? I mean, you go to the smallest Kirana shop and you will have UPI and you will have QR codes, etc. So, you know, traditionally, some of the Westerners thought that India perhaps will not take it up as efficiently, but you look how the penetration has happened. Likewise on lending, and I can tell you from personal experience that I mentioned there are more than 400 lending institutions in this country, fintech, which are working with NBFCs. Now, India has more than 10,000 NBFCs, and of course, we have scheduled commercial banks. Now, we have small finance banks, payments banks, etc. So, I believe all the stakeholders have realized that there are pockets of excellence which may exist, and they can be leveraged, or they can be, let's say, nurtured if you collaborate. And which is why the collaborative approach, whenever there's a collaborative approach which has been, you know, perhaps, let's say, institutionalized in this country, in my experience, and perhaps if you see around, you must have seen that it has blossomed. So if the customers benefited, and if you can deliver that experience in a compliant manner and at scale, it generally can work in this country because of A, the overall size of the country, and the demand which exists, right? So let's say if I'm talking about savings, 56% of Indian households, right, household wealth or household money is in savings. So it's either in the savings account or on the fixed deposit,
right?
Now assume that out of 100 rupees that, let's say, a household has, if 56 rupees is in savings, and if somebody can help you make that money work a little bit harder, right? Create a lot of, maybe the money has a little bit of fat. If somebody can help you create a little bit of muscle around it, right? With judicious level of workout per day, why would somebody not be open to such an idea, right? And it is as high as 56%. And these are all assets which yield, you know, south of 6%, 6.5%. So in a country which has an inflation which is similar to that level, and if more than half of household wealth is residing only there, then there is business to be made if you can play on the side of the customer. So I'm just trying to tell you that I believe that the overall ecosystem and the regulator is conscious of the fact that if something improves the financial health of this country, because if you make more money, you'll be able to spend more. It's consumerism. It's basics of economics, right? You guys are maybe, as we spoke. So I think it's something which the regulator looks at very, you know, positively. And when I talk about banks, in our conversations with banks, I think the banks have realized that there is a lot of synergies which can be, let's say, you know, exploited.
Right.
It has now been proven in InsurTech. It has been proven in, let's say, you know, lending very, you know, comprehensively. It has been proven in payments quite comprehensively. And I think liabilities and maybe some wealth management investments is the next frontier, right? Which is where we are trying to come in. So we are trying to come in to make people more sensitive to their overall financial health, make them consume products which they really need in ticket sizes that they really need. So no, let's say, mis-selling, right? So just consume what you need, consume what you can afford, right? And I think there's a lot of positives, at least, that I'm hearing from where we are.
It sounds very interesting and fascinating. You know, I just want to sort of give an analogy, and you can probably tell me, both of you rather can tell me where the thinking is off. Like, you know, I used to look at Netflix very early on, how the company evolved, right? And they built their business by taking other people's content, right? I mean, Disney and Warner Brothers or whoever it is. And then they quickly realized that, you know, we will have to get into it ourselves. We will have to get into original programming one day. It's a matter of time that these guys start pulling their content off, saying, you know what, you've made a platform based on our content. Enough is enough. We're pulling it back. We're going to set up our own shops as SWOT operators, and you figure it out yourself. In this case, right, I mean, do you foresee when you rely on partner banks for actual underwriting, is there a risk, I mean, for these partner banks to one fine day say, you know what, guys, like, you're playing on service, you're playing on quality, and you're playing a, you know, high quality advice. I can do that myself. It's for me. Like, I have the infrastructure. I have the brick and mortar to support it. And you know what? I have the touch points with these guys. I'll do it myself. I don't really need you guys anymore. Is that a real risk, or, you know, where is the analogy wrong? And you can probably throw some light on that.
No, I think it depends.
So yeah.
The very fact, as I mentioned earlier, Sharad, that you have to ask yourself really hard as to what kind of value are you adding as an organization, right? If you are convinced that the value that you are offering has, let's say, material and tangible value for the counterparty, really, then it can be a long-term relationship, right? I mean, if you look at any relationship, so as an organization, what kind of differentiation do you build? What kind of processes do you build? Can they be, let's say, created by somebody else overnight, right, etc.?
Yeah.
Right? So you have to ask yourself really hard that do you really do something which adds significant, tangible, consistent, sustainable value?
Sure.
Or do you do something that somebody is doing with you only perhaps, let's say, to perhaps save some time, save some cost, just test the market out, you know, do a little pilot and then see, okay, this works, this doesn't work. So I think from my perspective, I have seen that serious participants in this business look at it from a long-term perspective.
Good, yeah.
Banks, financial institutions at large do realize that people who are in fintech in general, perhaps some of them are same people who were doing banking 10 years back.
Right? Yeah.
So they do realize that these people also understand the industry dynamics and they understand what value do they bring to the table. So efficient organizations create very, let's say, deep entrenched partnerships, which can work very, very, very well. And if you see a lot of banks, a lot of financial institutions have actually tried to partner, so much so they've also tried to partner on an equity basis, right? I mean, some of them have invested in some entities.
Fair
so enough. I believe,
yeah.
Sharad, that it is all about the value that you can create. So if you are weak, of course, there will be exploitation.
Yeah.
If you're strong and convinced that the value that you bring to the table, right, is something which is not fly-by-night in nature, then I think there's business to be had.
No.
Having said that,
I
believe that as a young organization, right, as an ambitious organization, right, any startup or any organization in the fintech space, if, let's say, is wary of regulation or is wary of, let's say, talking to a regulated entity, then I think there is the need to look, you know, inwards a little hard. Because fundamentally, I believe that the business that we are making, or let's say anybody in that capacity, one should be clear about compliance, one should be clear about sustainability, one should be clear about dialogues with regulated entities. And I think if that's clear, and if your value is also clear, then there is business to be had.
Yeah.
Because
nobody turns away from a
lucrative partnership, right? I mean, in general.
No, I agree.
That's what
there is. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I totally am on board with that. That, you know, the fact that you're sort of, even the partner institutions see it as a long-term engagement in terms of driving value together and, you know, picking up pieces, I think that makes a lot of sense. And now I'm excited about the product as well. Are there any companies in the global world that you sort of look up to? I mean, I don't want to use the word comps or peers, but any aspirational companies and operating similarly that you sort of, you know, like a lot and look up to?
I think there is a variety of institutions out there. So neobanks or digital banks outside of India are much more evolved. I think Nikhil mentioned, he was in the UK. The UK has a bunch of such entities, right? Yeah. So I think there are some marquee names all of us may know. There is, let's say, Revolut, Starling, Chime, Varo, US entities also, right? New Bank in Brazil, they've built a phenomenal business.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of examples in when we look, let's say, towards the West. Towards the East also, I can see a lot of, you know, businesses are becoming quite aggressive. New licenses have been issued. The adoption has been phenomenal, mm-hmm. right? Even countries like Indonesia, Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong, Australia. All of these countries had banks. All of these countries had people who were with a mobile device. All of these countrymen, you know, let's say in those countries, citizens had already had bank accounts, right? I mean, this was the same problem. Let's say classical.
Yeah.
So the thing is that we look up to some of these institutions definitely to learn from their experiences, to learn from their broader development, let's say cycles, to learn from their, revenue and cost components, to learn from in case there is any, let's say, mistake, which we can learn from, right? If there is any success metric that we can try to be inspired by. So yeah. I think personally, as a young organization, we are very, let's say, open to learning. But I think we also have a fierce thought process of our own. And at the same time, we are also open to understanding what some of the larger entities have done, right?
Yeah.
Both outside and within the country as well. I think today there are some fantastic examples within the country as well. So personally, I'm very open to these situations.
I mean, one big challenge which is there when it comes to technology first place is that it quickly has a risk of getting commoditized, right? Hear me out. I mean, in the sense that what I'm trying to say is that if you look at for instance, in case of let's look at share trading, right? In share trading, there are a lot of now applications out there which of help you in execution, right? They all have very cutting edge, state of the art UI, and effectively there's a time after which, unless like coming to your same point earlier, unless there's a constant value add that's being added, the switching cost is very low for a customer, right?
Absolutely.
And one big piece of value add which I think most of you guys must be looking at in one way or the other is, deep learning, artificial intelligence. How can that actually unlock, different sorts of use cases for the for you guys, it will probably be a constant journey to figure out more and more of them, right? In order to make sure that there is a clear differentiation that exists. So, like from speaking from the perspective of big data and AI. Any use cases that you have already started seeing either through Savin or through the products that you like out there in the market, which you can throw your light on?
Yeah, you touched upon a very, let's say, important topic, Nikhil, that let's say exit barrier for a customer, right? So if there's a Me Too product and if something does get commoditized, as you said, right? And it absolutely can happen, right? So the thing is that, A, it is about consistent and incremental value creation for a customer. B, it is about creating some relationships with the customer. Now, relationships can also be created in the virtual world, right? Traditionally, a bank used to have an army of relationship managers who will come and visit you. If you're a big client, they will try to give you all the right advice. And the moment you look at some other bank, they will say, look, sir, ma'am, please don't do that. Look, I'm here. I'm giving you the best anyway. So why look elsewhere? I believe that the relationships that digital entities like us and digital platforms like us can create with customers can only be forged using some artificial intelligence and some data and intelligence, right? And insights that we bring to the customer, which should be hyper-personalized.
Yeah.
So we are basically in favor of creating hyper-personalized insights and making the customer really feel that A, we understand them well, B, we are actually advocating on their side and playing on their side, and C, we are advising them adequately. And the word adequate is very important because neither do we want to be, let's say, we don't want to err on either side of it, right?
Sure.
So we want to advise them adequately and consistently, right? In a fair and transparent manner. I believe that the moment you do this, the so-called exit barrier, let's say, right? Or the barrier to switch.
Yeah.
I mean, you switch when there is a superior product out there.
Of course,
and if there is a superior product out there, then you have to, let's say, take your hat off and say, good job, done, let's say, essentially. So the challenge is, can you stay ahead of the curve? Can you push yourself hard? Can you create experiences and products which do satisfy customers across economic cycles? You want to sell a product A, the customer is not caring about it. You keep selling it, you'll be dead. So the thing is that we are very, very clear that so long as we stay ahead of the curve or abreast of the curve, right, and we create opportunities, products and services for the customer, automatically we create value. Now, coming to your second part, right, wherein you said that how do we see usage of artificial intelligence, use cases thereof? See, I personally see that there is a lot of effort and cost and infrastructure which large institutions have had to deploy towards servicing customers.
Right.
See, at the end of the day, one big problem that I also see, and it's a problem that we are trying to solve, by the way, one of the problems, right, is that, let's say if I have 1 million customers, can I talk to all those 1 million customers in one language? Right? How do I reach out to them?
Mm-hmm.
Today, you may be getting an SMS wherein somebody may have pitched you a 1 lakh rupee personal loan.
Right.
Not looking at the fact that you may be having a, let's say, I don't know, X lakh rupees in deposits, X crore rupees in deposits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is not personalized. It is impersonalized conversation. Sometimes such campaigns are done. Sometimes such conversation is done, right? So my view is that on customer interaction and customer service, there is a big play out there in terms of data and use of artificial intelligence. All banking services and queries, right? We have studied that 20 to 25 queries form about 90 to 95% of queries that people actually check in a banking ecosystem, right? But those 20 queries could be phrased in maybe, 200 ways, let's say, right? And if you become vernacular, that 200 may become 2000, let's say, right? So if you train people, if you train warm bodies, and you expect to, you know, let's say, address all those situations, it can be very expensive, very, you know, time-taking, right? And there's, of course, you know, cost of attrition or risk of attrition.
Right.
So I believe there's a big play in usage of technology to create personalized, let's say, situations and mechanisms by which queries can be addressed. How you bring about, let's say, transparency, right? How you bring about, sometimes you have a value which is hidden and you don't even know because nobody is there to tell you that. So your own bank account, your own debit card, your own credit card, your own insurance company, your own mutual fund may be bringing something to you which they may have sent in a leaflet, but it has never caught your attention again, right? It may still be there somewhere. That offer may be there, reward may be there, some, let's say, you know. So what I'm trying to say is that customer engagement, customer service, and customer complaint management, which basically is an opportunity as far as an entity is concerned, because I look at it as an opportunity either to improve your product or to perhaps give some value back to the customer. I think there's a tremendous opportunity to invoke artificial intelligence in this, maybe ML. We currently are building some chatbot products of our own.
Right.
We have studied a few products across the globe. There are use cases wherein you could have robotic calling. Right. WhatsApp has become very big in this country. It's becoming increasingly big in terms of creating and managing, let's say, conversations. There are text-to-speech converters. There are people who can hold a conversation. We are very passionate about humanoid, I call it, humanoid digital capabilities, right? So we want to create digital capabilities, but we do not want to be absolutely, let's say, shut to the fact that there is a value attached to a human. But at what point do you invoke that handshake becomes very important, right? So that also should be driven by technology. That also should be driven by data and understanding of that data, situations and permutation combination, right? And that at scale can only be done by languages, you know, let's say by understanding what's happening. So I think from our standpoint, these are some of the areas which we are very passionate about. B, we understand there's a lot of value to be unlocked. So we are, you know, kind of working quite hard on these things.
No, this is tremendously exciting, Jitin. And thanks a lot for throwing light on how you view this space evolving. It's obviously, it's by design. It cannot be a simplistic conversation. And that's why we have taken almost 50 minutes of your time. So, no, thanks a lot for that and hope you had fun.
I didn't realize. So, it flowed like a river. I didn't realize it's 50 minutes. But yes, yeah,
that's the charm that me and Sharad bring to the table, you know. That,
absolutely. I will really lose time.
This was a fascinating chat, Jitin. And good luck with Savin. Obviously, we'll be cheering for it from the sidelines and look at the product development closely as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Sounds very exciting.
Thank you.
Quite kind of bullish here. So thanks for your time.
And yeah, with that, I can probably, do the thing we always do. This is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.